And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Bubba and the Bloom, episode 188, coming at you on a Tuesday night, talking 2025. We told you we're moving on to 2025, folks, with our annual draft and hold primer, coming at you earlier than usual for many reasons, because schedules have changed. But we're going to get you ready with a whole bunch of strategy involved in your draft and hold formats, your NFBC 50s, your draft champions, 50 round, we'll get to that in a minute. Until then, though, you can find me on Twitter at BDNTrick, the podcast at Bubba Bloom Pod. My co-host, as always, on Twitter at Ryan BHQ. Ryan, how are we doing, my friend?
I'm good. I'm back.
Yes.
Had a good time. Had a great time down in Atlanta. We did the sports tour of Atlanta.
You did it all.
It was like actually pretty grueling. Like, we got in Thursday night.
This is me not feeling sorry for you.
Yeah, no, I don't. You'll feel sorry for me maybe at the end of this agenda. But yeah, I got in Thursday night. We did the tour of Mercedes-Benz Stadium where the Falcons play. That was cool. Got to go in the locker room, all that. College Football Hall of Fame. Got to play NCAA in the College Football Hall of Fame.
Oh, they had a little your dream they had come a little true.
Yeah, they had a little exhibit. So did that. We went to a Atlanta Hawks game.
Nice. Just,
I mean, whatever, something. And
can
then,
you now name a few players at least?
No. Outside of Trae Young, no.
Trae Young, there you go.
And then, Georgia, Tennessee was awesome, and flights were good and all that, so that was good. And then reality hit. This is where you start to feel sorry for me, right? We had a sick kid yesterday who's home today. We're getting hit by a bomb cyclone in Oregon at the moment.
You didn't respond to my tweet on that, so I figured you weren't too pumped.
they're like hurricanes. There's categories to them. I didn't even know that. This is a category 4 or 5, which is not good. So
not good at all.
So yeah, reality's back, but I'm doing good. I'm refreshed, had a good time, and ready to roll, man.
That's good to hear. Yeah, it looked like an awesome trip. At first, I was sitting there going, man, Wisconsin's actually going to make this a game. You might have missed going to a real good one in Madison, but still worked out for you.
I had one eye on that out-of-town scoreboard at the because it was on at the same time as Georgia, Tennessee. But.
Yeah. Now, that hurricane going through the Northwest, it's supposed to come as far south as we might get 1 to 2 inches of rain Friday, Saturday. For us, that's a lot in like a short period of time because we don't get a lot of rain here. So I can only imagine what you guys are going to get where you're at. If we're getting an inch or two, we want it. Not good for you guys, though, in the grand scheme of things. So hopefully everything stays safe. And, you know, hopefully Thursday night you're allowed to take part in something we're doing Thursday night, Ryan. Did you know that we're doing a live Gladiator draft on Thursday night?
Fired up. Mostly, I mean, the draft will be fun. We did this last year. The draft will be fun. But it was awesome to see. We basically had within the draft opening on the NFBC lobby, the Gladiator draft, we had basically our entire Patreon in there signed up, ready to go. We put the link out to the Patreon and like within an hour or two,
yep,
we had pretty much the entire league filled with people in our Patreon and in our Discord, which I don't know. We were texting each other like, to us, that is like, that's awesome. It's a perk of being, I guess, in the Patreon and being a part of the show almost at that point. But there was just like the enthusiasm and all that stuff about getting signed up. It was really cool. We didn't get the full 15. Yeah. You gotta account for the Zach Waxman effect. But we got I think 13 out of 15.
13. Yep.
Yeah, in our Gladiator, which is gonna be the same time. Actually, it'll be 8:30, right? 8:30 Pacific, yep, on Thursday night. Sharp, because that's when the draft starts.
So we might start a couple minutes earlier to get you guys ready for it, and then the draft starts at 8:30 Pacific time.
But basically going to be like a de facto listener league, so I'm super stoked. Super stoked.
And if you want to have your chance to get into future ones and knowing ahead of time, you just got to join the Bubba and the Bloom Patreon, patreon.com/BubbaBloom, gets you in the old Discord there. Just going to throw it out there. Amongst other perks that come with being in there, one we'll talk about later in the show. That will be a part of that situation as well. So, yeah, really cool to see the group. It's just it's a growing deal, a slowly growing deal as we knew it would be in November. And it's a fun group. It's active in there. Guys are having a good time, talking a lot, mm-hmm, of strategy, talking a lot of games, different fantasy stuff. Guys drafting, sharing notes, and asking questions. And it's going to be a fun year in that chat. So come join. You'll have some fun. So all I can say there, the easy, not so annoying sales pitch for you.
There you go.
All righty. Draft and holds, Ryan. This is one thing you said you want to do more of this year. 2 years ago, I did really well. This past year, not so much. You did pretty well this past year. Let's get to the basics of it, and then we'll expand throughout the show quite a bit. Ryan, he put together some awesome little charts and ideas on this. He's kind of, I'm just going to steer the ship is what it feels like on this, but the format kind of got to it early on. It's 50 rounds. Draft and hold means you draft and you hold. There's no fab. So you still set your lineup weekly. You're 14 hitters, 9 pitchers. You hitters, you get the bye weekly. Pitchers, once a week. And you just pray you have enough healthy bodies by the end of the season. That's the easiest way to explain it. What else would you like to mention about the format, Ryan?
I mean, that's pretty much it. It is becoming my favorite format because, A, it helps us get through these bomb cyclones in the winter and you're drafting while you're able to do it. But B, like you said, there's no fab. And I know for me and you, Sunday nights with little kids, like there's a ceiling on what we can actually do with our fab teams. So it's a really fun way. I'd like to say in previous years, I used it as prep for my actual leagues, like in March. And that, I think that's like a common refrain. I'm going at it at a totally I'm drafting these to win. It's not just for prep. I'm putting a lot more prep in the actual draft and holds themselves as opposed to like prepping as I go. And that means, as we'll get to when we look at some of the teams that were successful in 2024, being able to hit on some of these guys in these middle and late, even 40 plus rounds, it's huge. So it's my favorite format. I'm pumped for this show. We'll try and keep it. I know a lot of folks listening have probably played more draft and holds than we have, but then I know there are also some that are new to the format, and we want to kind of accommodate everybody. It's pretty much on when we play draft and holds. It's on the NFBC. Typically, they have an overall contest called the Draft Champion. So you'll hear us say DCs all the time. That's kind of the common lingo. That's the NFBC's kind of overall name for their tournament. $150 to get in.
15 teams,
$1,000, I believe, to the winner. And then there's an overall prize and stuff like that. But then there are other sites. I know Fantrax. I don't know if they have an overall thing, but they have draft and hold leagues that are pretty much the same thing, that are kind of the prize monies contained to that league. So it's getting more prevalent as we go.
A couple more things there for the NFBC. If you want to play 12 teams instead of 15s, the NFBC 50s, it's $50 to get into. The overall prize pool is not the same, but you can do those as well. And you mentioned Fantrax. I've played in a few of those in the past with some fun members of Baseball 365 over on Facebook. You can customize the scoring system to how you want. They basically set it up to, biweekly hitters, weekly. It's similar to NFBC, but they used OBP instead of average, stuff along those lines. So you can tweak it as much as you want. On Fantrax, they don't have an overall. Usually it's just a league by league. So you can customize entry fees, payouts, you name it. You can have your fun with that. But like Ryan said, we're going to mainly stick to NFBC and mainly be on the 15-team draft champions. It's kind of what we'll be talking about here. But if you have questions in the future, let us know. We can help you out the best we can. And anything else, like Ryan said, is we're going to talk about some guys that are like Steve Weimer, probably one of the best DC players ever. We'll mention him later. DiPietro and many others play great. So we can have some fun with that as well. All right, roster construction. It's a great question asked so many times. Scott Burks is in the chat here. Your uncle and Scott asked me questions, and I had many beers, and thinking back, I probably misspoke in a roundabout way, but we'll get it covered.
About draft and holds or just
roster construction. We're talking roster construction. Okay. So I think I gave him a too high of a number on pitching, but we'll get that covered here, because looking at your sheet kind of comes more in line with what I was trying to stay here when things are said and done. So Ryan will pull up the first graph for those watching on the YouTube situation, but you still need to set your roster. Your 14 hitters, your 9 pitchers, you have your catcher, first base, second base, third, middle, corner, 5 outfielders, utility, and then your 9 pitchers. So Ryan, when we look at this chart, what kind of, I guess this isn't the gold standard, but there's obviously ways to go about it. So when you look at this, what are you taking away?
Yeah, so it's probably the most common question that I think that we got leading up to this show is just how many catchers, how many relievers, how many starters. So what I did was I took every pick, and that's another kind of side benefit why we use the NFBC so often for analysis and things like that. Everything's open source. You can grab all this stuff. So I took, there were 5,000, just over 5,000 teams in last year's, in 2024's draft champions contest. And so I downloaded every single pick and ran a bunch of numbers for this show. So what we're looking at here is the overall roster build from all draft and hold teams, as well as the top 50 overall, as well as the top 10, to see if there are any kind of changes in there. And there were not. So there wasn't like some type of magic formula that the best teams had different roster builds or roster, I guess, by position roster builds than all teams. But what you folks on YouTube and looking at the live stream are seeing is last season, how many players by position were on each team. So basically there are four catchers, and I'll talk about this in just a sec. There are five first basemen, five second basemen, four shortstops, five third basemen, 13 outfielders, 16 starters, and six relievers. That adds up to like 59. And why does that add up to 59, Bubba? I'll throw that back to you.
Why does that add up to 59? Because you're taking averages of that many teams. So it'll, I'm going to guess, never come out to the exact 50 when you're doing that.
Multi-position players.
Oh, that's what I actually literally wrote down on my piece of paper, was to bring up multi-position right here as you were saying.
It's on
that.
The paper. There it is. Yep. I can see the note.
Yeah, as you were saying that, so that makes sense. Multi-position, because I was going to say, how does this factor into that? But now we're hitting that already.
Yeah. So what the chart shows is...
real quick, how do you get multi-position pitchers?
They have it broken out by SP and RP. Gotcha. So I don't know. Fangraphs does. So gotcha. I took some liberties by splitting that out. Basically, if they were RP, they were relievers, and then anything else, they were starters, because there are so many kind of hybrids out there. But in general, so we also have like a recommended column on the right side there. It's kind of what I try and target by position. Last season, teams on average drafted 16 starting pitchers, and we'll round up and say six relievers, and that adds up to 22 according to my college educated math. And that really is the I don't want to say ideal, but that's the most normal type of roster build, is to do 28 hitters, 22 pitchers. Of those 22 pitchers, it's roughly 16 and 6 starting pitchers and relievers. You've got, I recommend trying to get four at every position. That does not add, that adds up to over 50. So four catchers, four first basemen, four second, short, and third, and then 12 outfielders. That adds up to 54 total. That kind of means, and the numbers kind of bore this out, that you've got roughly four multi-position guys on your team out of 28 hitters. So not everyone's going to be able to get four at every position, but if you take a few of those multi-position guys, which is super important in draft and hold, remember, because you cannot do fab throughout the season, that's kind of how you would ideally get to this number that's higher than 50, is by adding in those multi-position guys.
Yep, makes a lot of sense there. So 22 pitchers, I usually go probably more on the 23 side of it, just because I don't go heavy pitching early as much, so I take more depth late, which is we'll talk about roster construction and why we do what we do in certain positions here. But like you said, this is kind of the recommendation, but like, we'll have a question coming up of, do you take three catchers or four catchers? We've had, there was actually good discussion on that in the Discord about how it's worked and how it hasn't worked. And that's why these are recommendations. There's no, like, I think I had three first basemen in the league last year. By August, I had zero. So yeah. I literally had none, and all of a sudden Anthony Rizzo came back and I was happy. I tweeted that. I said, and so that's just kind of the nature of the beast of these positions. A lot of the time you can get second base, shortstop eligible guys together. Like, I've drafted like Luke Rayleigh's first base outfield. I have Goodman's catcher outfield. You have those kind of flexibilities as well as you go through your draft. So like you mentioned, that gives you your 54, and you can mix and match. And that's why when Ryan and I talk a lot about, this guy's got middle and CI, this guy's got middle outfield, CI outfield, something like that. It's like, the dream situation. And that's why we always loved Ringifo so much because he played every single position. And you basically, as long as he wasn't hurt, which he eventually got hurt, but as long as he wasn't, you could fill in a lot of options based on the rest of your team. So those kind of guys, they get a little elevated in these drafts. Not as much as I think they used to, honestly, but they do get a little push.
And they should. And I think even more than, because maybe listeners are thinking, okay, well, how much do you factor in? It's an age-old question. Like, how much do you factor in multi-position eligibility? I think it's more than the tiebreaker. Like, I think if two guys are even, you definitely take the multi-position eligible guy. I think even if, again, depending if, you know, if how flexible your team is so far, even if someone's projected for a buck or two higher, I would still probably go multi-position in draft and hold, just because you cannot pivot when injuries happen. One other thing that I noticed when running these numbers on averages for last year, notice how shortstop is a full player, sometimes player and a half below second base, third base, first base. Mm-hmm. There were not as many multi-position players that qualified at shortstop than did any other position. That tells me it's even a little bit tougher, even though you'll hear all off season shortstop's deep. There's top players at shortstop. It's even harder to get those multi-position guys that qualify at short. So that was one that stuck out to me to prioritize shortstop even more, early in drafts.
Yeah, no, it checks out. It'll be fun to see, like, I don't know if by the end of November or end of December, to see how these early drafts ADPs kind of pencil out to this. Like, if we do the first X amount of picks, how many catchers, how many, like, that's just crazy talk, but it'd be fun to see how many kind of go in those situations that makes any sense at all. But yeah, so this is the breakdown, and we were going to say, how do you tackle certain positions? So, you know, we'll start with the best position in all of fantasy baseball. we'll start with the catcher position, and that's why I think it's a fun question, and I'll just bring the listener question up now, and we can answer it as we're talking about this situation. And Martin Sikolsky from the Discord says, as we all know, catchers matter. How many are you rostering in your DC? I've been leaning towards four, but I've seen people do three, and I don't have the whole thing in front of me, but there's a big interaction. Some guy's saying, I wish I had a fourth because I could have used one when I was using X, or, you know, my catcher twos and threes didn't really pan out. And then, like, I remember Ben Tidd came in and said, well, I only had three and it worked out this time, but I had four in another league. It didn't work out at all. My point being, it's not a perfect formula, but yeah. I'll let you have the floor, Ryan, since, you know, I'm the catcher guy. What's your thoughts on how you approach the catcher position in DCs?
I tend to get four and I tend to get two early, just because the volume can matter so much more when you get those early catchers. And again, you cannot pivot, but as we can see, a lot of the, it was basically three and a half last year. So half the teams took three catchers, half the teams took four. That there's the argument to be made that if you take two early catchers, I know James Anderson kind of made this point in our meatball draft when he was writing that up. If you take like William Contreras, do you really need to take a fourth catcher? Like, yes, you are kind of going out on a limb and praying for health, but you've invested so much in that spot already. It might make sense to just kind of not take that fourth and invest that spot somewhere else. And if William Contreras gets hurt, it sucks. But like, honestly, a lot of times, do you even want that fourth catcher that you take in the 45th round in your lineup anyway? So that's really kind of the case for three. I would never go two. But that's the case for three, is you can kind of take that four spot, which is someone who's probably really bad, and use that somewhere else.
What I tend to do is go with three main guys, like one I really like, and then two guys I could rotate around with if I have to. But it seems like more often than not, I will take a fourth with one of my last picks, but it's like a spec. Like I did Austin Wells, because I was like, okay, when's he going to come up and make an impact? This year at catcher, and we'll talk about this more in the preview and some other articles, there's about seven or eight potential guys that could get called up this year that I think are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
So those could be guys we're taking a dart on late, and if they don't pan out, so be it. It stinks. Like, you'd rather have a, you know, an outfielder or whatever. I could see the argument against this. That's how I approach the position. I don't have to walk away with four. If I take a fourth catcher, it's usually like a spec guy late to see how things pan out. And just see where it goes there. I jumped a little early in my latest draft for Hunter Goodman as my third catcher, just because I love the upside there. Catcher outfield upside, he's playing every day. Just his power makes him at least outfield viable to me. In a perfect world, probably not an outfield situation. but just that flexibility of, oh, my guys start getting hurt, you'll take it. So that's the only reason why I jumped him. I'm pretty high on him. But for the most part, like, I'd go a main guy early if I can. Like, I went Logan Ohapi in this one. And then I backed him up with two guys, like Kiber Ruiz for batting average, and then Hunter Goodman later. That's where I'm sitting in that league right now. I'm debating taking a fourth late. Otherwise, I'll just stick with three, like you were saying.
The last thing I'll add with catcher is sometimes, depending on how injuries shake out, and this is kind of like a no-no in fab leagues, but sometimes, oftentimes even, you will start a catcher at utility.
Yep.
Because you just have so many injuries on your team that there's really like no, like I, you just said you drafted Hunter Goodman, Bubba. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if Hunter Goodman's playing outfield for you. So
yeah,
just 100%. Because of injuries. So it's one of those, like in fab leagues, it's like, no, never have a catcher utility. Well, sometimes you have to, just because you have no roster flexibility. Even Sal Perez, who's catcher first base, like you could start him at first base if you had to. So it's kind of like I'll talk about in fab leagues where like catchers with multiple position eligibility doesn't really matter because you just start him at catcher. That's not always the case in drafting holds.
Like, weirdly enough, and you're gonna laugh at this, but in a format like this, a late Victor Caratini has a lot more value than he does in other formats. He's catcher first, man.
21 minutes in, and Bubba's talking Victor Caratini.
Hey, open the box.
It's a good it's a good point. It's a really good point. You will find yourself in those situations by the end of the season.
Most definitely. All right, let's talk closers now, because this is a fun one. Some people think, do you need to go aggressive on closers? We know they disappear pretty quick. How do you spec on closers? So on and so forth. Ryan, you mentioned roughly 6 relief pitchers as the target here. How do you approach closers in this? Because they do get pushed up quite a bit.
They do. Again, just because, again, there is no fab and you can't, you draft and hold. So that closers do get pushed up just because the uncertainty of the position, the guys that we think are certain with skills in the role, those guys are expensive. So typically what I've seen is if you want to get a top closer, it's the first 5 rounds in a 15-team league, maybe 6. If you get lucky, if you want to get your second closer, it's what, 10th or 12th round in a 15-teamer?
That's fair.
And then if you want a third, you can do it. You can do it, but you're looking more in like the mid-teens, and that's almost getting into spec territory the way this year's pool is hanging out. The reliever averages from last year were lower than I thought, like 5 to 6 relievers per team. That's basically 2 closers and then like 3 other guys. And there's a couple different ways. And I'll throw it back to you, but there's a couple ways you can do it. You can handcuff. And so by handcuffing, what that is basically you would take the closer on whatever team, and then you would take their setup man later on. That has factored into my strategy. If there's a closer with a really good setup man, I would actually prioritize that close. Like, that's a tiebreaker for me. I take that closer and then take the strong setup man as a handcuff later on. You can also go like the elite, like the Matt Strom, like the elite ratio guys who probably don't have a shot at closing, but you know you're going to get volume of good ratios. And then there are kind of the third way to attack closers, again, late in drafts, is those just pure specs, right? The guys that have the skills, they don't have the role. They could be on a totally separate team from any other closer that you have on your team. If you hit on that, then you get 3 or 4 closers and you're golden. But obviously there's risk to doing that too. So,
yeah, one of my potential downfalls in these is I think later in the drafts, I start just going spec and reliever heavy. And maybe I don't have as many starting pitchers in the
end. It's tempting. Like, there's always so many really good like reliever skills available in like the 45th round. I'm the same way.
Because I know there was at least one DC last year where out of my 9 pitchers, there was weeks I'd have 6 relievers in there towards the end of the season. I know I had more than 6 on my teams, I'm trying to say. Because I got a lot of Ursig, Neris, we obviously talked about, he wasn't involved there, but the MacArthur, he was one of my most rostered players last year across the DCs and 50s. So I like to spec. You're talking about types of specs. I do like to get at least one big guy early. I've noticed there's a pocket, if you don't mind, like the mid-tiers of the Ursigs, Luke Weavers and stuff right now. You can make hay a little later if you want to be aggressive then. It's risky, but you can do it. try to get one of the big guys, pair him with one of those Weaver, Irsig tier type guys, and then start peppering later on would be my two cents. And like you said, it's either the handcuff guys are pretty strong, or I'd start picking on some good teams that have like really good seventh and eighth inning guys and just start going crazy there. That's why I loved Irsig in Oakland, because we didn't know if Miller was going to be a closer, and I thought he was that good. So that was where he stood out for me. If we're talking San Diego, Jeremiah Estrada is a guy that's going to be pretty popular that you could look at. You can just go down the list with some of these other teams and pick them apart and have some decent options, at least in the back end of some bullpens. Like the Yankees are always stacked in the bullpen department. So those would be the guys I'd be specking on with you. I wouldn't so much go – well, I'll ask you this before we get into starters. With the landscape of a lot of, I guess, openers or long relievers we've seen lately, do you maybe use like maybe one or two SPs and like kind of have like another tier? You know what I'm trying to say? Not SP, yeah. Not RP, because there's a lot of those kind of guys. That, like originally, Ryan Walker was more of a long reliever, turn closer eventually. He had some spot starts. He had some middle stuff. Like guys like that stand out to me that could be kind of interesting in a different format. It's just realize they might not get saves. They might not get wins. So you better hope they get good ratios and strikeouts.
Right. And it's just, and it's also just hard to predict. Will they stay in that role all year? I typically don't, but maybe there's probably room for one of those guys on a team. Just, you know, when in doubt, you can throw him in and yeah, the ceiling's low because you're not getting wins or saves, but the other stuff might be okay.
Yeah, like Michael C. in the chat says, Buto is the swingman type. I like, yeah, 100%. And he should be late in the games, but, you know, when he came back this past year, he was a middle guy. So you had to kind of play that game.
Your boy Yarbrough, cheat code Yarbrough.
Yarbrough was awesome. That's
more a follower, but yeah. Still.
Well, and that'll get me into, we'll talk starters, and I'll save part of it for that, but you're mentioning about 16 starters. Some, if you want to round up the other way, 17 starters, depending on how you look at this. How do you attack the starting pitching position? Because when main event season comes out, it's the old boring, they're going to get pushed up. Early on here in DCs, you can play around a little bit if you want in the pitching pool. If you don't go super early, you can find yourself in a strikeout hole. I'll admit that much. But all in all, you just need health and depth at that position. So how are you approaching the starting pitching position?
Right. So like what goes up, other things must come down. That's probably not the exact quote, but with relievers pushed up. So with relievers getting pushed up so much and it being so far away from opening day, early drafters, even in January, like before pitchers and catchers report, it feels riskier to take early starting pitching just because there's more time for these guys to break. Typically, how I attack starting pitching is I go more volume and in the middle rounds than I would in a fab league. So I will probably wait in a lot of draft and holds until the fourth or fifth round to grab my first starting pitcher and then attack it pretty hard in like rounds 8 through 12, because I know some of these guys are going to break, but I'm going to try and kind of volume my way to at least have so many more kind of, I don't know, throws at the dartboard that if enough stick, I'm good to go. I also try, the other big thing with starting pitching is, and this came up in the Discord earlier, is I typically will be drafting my 7th, 8th, 9th starters before I'm filling out the rest of my hitting lineup. Just again, common theme, just try and get as many starting pitchers in those middle rounds as possible, because a bunch are going to break, but if you have enough to kind of get you through that, I think you're going to be good. It's going to cost you elsewhere in other spots, right? It's a zero sum game. But that's how I have attacked starting pitching, because what you'll find is too in those late rounds, as we were just talking about with relievers, they're like look like so many good reliever prospects out there. Starting pitching is like you really got to dig for guys who aren't even gonna enter the league in rotations on opening day. So it thins out quick.
Well, that's where I was gonna go with this. What's getting tricky right now? Like I'm in the middle rounds, like 25, 26. And there are a ton of guys that we've talked about in the review shows that we like Cade Povich, Zach Lytle, Grant Holmes, so on and so forth. They're currently projected to work out of the bullpen right now on these teams. And so you got to sit there and go, okay, in a perfect world, they should be starting, but they're not potentially. That could change. We are just using roster resource right now. So, you know, use your own decisions in this. But it comes down, like, even if you look at the projection models, they'll have like Zach Lytle. I think he had like 43 spot games, 23 were starts. So they're even projecting him to work out of the pen, if you know, if you understand what I'm trying to say here. So there's, and same with Povich and these other, like Povich is actually predicted to start in AAA right now for Baltimore. And I think he's better than some of the guys in the rotation personally.
Behind our guy, Trevor Rogers.
I don't think Trevor Rogers is even alive, but let me check. Yeah. Now that you mentioned it, I got to look. Trevor Rogers, the Orioles rotation right now, Eflin, G-Rod, Kramer, Suarez, and Trevor Rogers. Yes, yeah. They have Povich in the minors right now. So those are the kind of decisions you have to make also, is do you want to take on these guys that are either in the bullpen or AAA that you think, like, Grant Holmes was so good for Atlanta to finish the season. How does he not start? Like, they have Ian Anderson starting the rotation. I don't believe that for one second. But it's stuff like that that could totally derail a draft when you're like, okay, I'm drafting starting pitchers, and now they're not starting pitchers. So that makes things tricky. So that goes into my earlier question of Longman. Do you kind of take a few of those that you think will at least get you 15 starts throughout the season but might not be anchored into the rotation?
I mean, that's a good way to frame it, is because, I mean, we talk all the time during the season, like a sixth starter, seventh starter, they are going to get time at some point. And if anything, it's even beneficial to take those guys, because you kind of stagger, in theory, you stagger when those pitchers are going to make it. You theoretically have a fully healthy starting pitching staff on opening day. Some of those guys are going to break down. You want some six or seven starters later on to be healthy during the season when inevitably you will need it. So yes, I will absolutely be targeting, if Cade Povich is super cheap, for example, that type of pitcher who is not quote unquote penciled into the rotation right now, but will be at some point once injuries inevitably hit.
Scott Winhold in the chat here says, what about using your first four picks on starting pitchers? Yeah. Witnessed that recently.
You've seen that out in the wild. I would not recommend personally.
I can't stomach it. Let's put it that way. And I have a large stomach, so I can't do it.
Yeah.
All right. Are we good with positions? You ready to talk categories?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Let's hit up on some category targets here. Ryan will get that sheet going here, but it's kind of an interesting one. We're talking the 80th percentile for hitters, and then we'll get to some of the other goodies here. And Ryan is pulling that up. So, Ryan, what are we looking at when we talk hitters, pitchers, percentiles?
All right. So, yes, this is, again, from last season's draft champions on the NFBC standings, and things change every year. So these are just guidelines, but it's a nice way to kind of see how balanced your team is, because, again, you cannot fab, you cannot trade. The team you draft is the team you got. So what we've got on the screen, and I'm putting all this in a Patreon article as well. So basically, like, all my notes and research and that sort of thing will all be in an article to reference as well. That'll probably come out on Wednesday. But it's important to have these totals in mind and these targets in mind as you're drafting. I mean, projections are super noisy. We don't know how good they are, that sort of thing. But just from a balance standpoint, what I like to look at is, as opposed to just like the totals, I like to look at the per hitter averages. It just makes a little bit more sense to me. So on average in 2024, your average hitter needed 20 home runs to finish in the 80th percentile and 13 steals. Steals have gone up a lot in the last two seasons with the rule changes. So 20 home runs and 13 steals. And the biggest number, the most important number of all these categories, it's not even a category, is at-bats.
Yep.
At-bats correlates so well, and Jeff Zimmerman's done this. Steve Weimer's a big proponent of this. At-bats correlate so well with hitting standings at the end of the year, and it makes sense. Just the more volume you have, the better you're going to do. And a lot of that is just avoiding injuries, but a lot of that is when you're drafting, you need to put a pin on playing time and prioritize that. So your 80th percentile at-bats per hitter was 526. So this also, this is for your 14 hitters. So this includes catchers. So really, like, catchers don't run in general. I mean, outside of the legends, but if you're taking 13 starting or stolen bases per hitter, and you take two catchers that don't run, that number is actually more like 15 or 16 on your non-catcher position. So that's something to keep in mind. But those are the targets that I'm trying to hit with, not with every pick, but that's the balance I'm trying to achieve here.
Yeah, and there's software to do that, and we'll get to that in a minute, potentially, to look at these situations. But it is an interesting thing to look at, and that's why you mentioned the at-bats part, and Weimer's talked about it. He's written about it for HQ and other places, and it's a big thing, and it's trickier, it feels like, in recent years because there's so much more platooning going on in baseball, where you used to be able to kind of pencil in a good chunk of lineups. It doesn't happen as often anymore, but it's interesting because – there's a lot of boring guys, but they will play every day. And in a DC, it doesn't have to be one of your starters because they're boring. They probably don't go early in a draft. But as drafts go on, that gets more interesting. Like I was talking with someone a little bit ago. I just picked up my third second baseman or something. And I picked up Nick Gonzalez of Pittsburgh, who hit 270 with 7 homers and 5 steals last year in a limited time. If you pencil that out throughout a season, if he starts every day, now, does he stay that good? Who knows? But just do the quick math on 7 and 5 over, what was it, like 40, 50 games? That pencils out pretty close to what you're looking for here, or maybe a little better. It's a boring player, but he's going to put up those numbers. And in a DC, that's tremendous when you're trying to figure things out when injuries and everything come into play. Like Jonah Bride's a guy that I really like in these formats because he'll play every day in Miami. He is boring as all hell, but he'll play every day. And those guys are clutch here. I know it's kind of beating a dead horse here at this point, but we don't always have to go flashy. This is when we'll start talking, taking these upside guys that aren't even providing you technically stats for part of the season because they're prospects, or, we already know they're injured, so you're getting them later in the draft. But when you're trying to do this kind of, put together, my guys are averaging these numbers, well, they're giving you zeros for a lot of it. And that changes things as well. So it is a different approach. Do you have any strategies in trying to hit these numbers, or is it kind of that's a really, really broad question because of all the, options, but yeah.
Yeah, no, nothing nothing strategic. It's more just a focus on looking at, like, Nick Gonzalez is a great example. Like, I think the playing time will be there. This is also something you might want to look at some of the defensive metrics to see if, that drives playing time, especially for some of these fast guys. But I honestly think a lot of this at bats total and hitting your at bat target is injury avoidance. And depending on who you talk to, that's a skill, that's luck. It's probably a blend of both, but avoiding injuries is by far the biggest pathway to hitting these. It's obvious, but I don't have any magic strategy to avoid injuries. I think that's really the biggest thing. But it also, just from a roster construction standpoint too, I think we have a note of this on the end, like the way you utilize your backups is huge. So yeah. For example, you took Royce Lewis infamously in the August meatball draft early, and you backed him up very quickly at third base with Alex Bregman. So there's kind of strategies you can do from a roster construction. Your kind of weakest link or your most injury prone hitter, prioritize a backup behind that guy over other positions that may seem safer, even though, again, it's so hard to predict.
Yep, very, very true. Ezra's last name has a good one. The more at bats you have equals the more players that didn't suck enough to lose.
That too. Yes, that's that
very
too.
True as well.
You did not have Victor Scott not racking up at bats last season. That's a
big fantasy would have told you not to. Right. Speaking of injuries, though, I know I've said this one many times. At FPAS, we heard 70% of starting pitchers were injured last year. Ron Chandler says, key fact from the upcoming baseball forecaster: in 2019, 63% of IL went to pitchers. Since then, went to 66% in 21, 69% in 22, all the way to 74% this past year. So, Ryan, we just talked about just getting consistent at bats, avoiding injury. When we see stats like this, does this make you actually want to take more pitchers to try to hit these totals and take fewer hitters? Or does it make you try to admit, you can't predict injuries, but if 3/4 of the pitchers are getting hurt, how are you going about that?
That is why I prioritize the volume of starting pitchers, which is kind of what I was just talking about. That is why. Like I'm of the opinion that pitchers are going to get hurt. We can't reasonably predict which ones they're going to be. So give yourself as many shots as possible and hit those. Yes, it hurts you on the hitting side. You have to get lucky somewhere with injury avoidance, but that's generally, I do go a little bit more volume on the pitcher side, but could be wrong. I don't know.
So when looking at these pitching totals here, do you have anything to talk about here? We just talked hitters, 80th percentile pitchers. You got K's, wins, saves, ERA and WHIP for us. It is, if people compare these to, say, 12-team OCs, 15-team main events, they're lower because of the replacement value is not there. So that's something to keep in mind when you are, like we talk like in an OC, for instance, you almost want three closers because you're going to need close to 90 saves when it's all said and done. Here you need 71, and that's where people will argue get two elite guys and you're almost locked in and you could almost avoid too many extra relievers as long as these guys you think stay healthy. At the same time, if you only need 71, I've seen the argument, you get like one good guy and you can spec all day on the rest.
Yep. There are both ways. You could have had a class A or a Helsley that gets you 45 or 47 out of the 71 that you need. And then, yeah, you can cobble together 20 odd saves or whatever from specs. I don't use the pitcher targets really as much because there's not much of a balance like there is for hitting, trying to balance power, speed and batting average for pitchers. The 71 saves is good to know because, yes, if you do hit on two good closers, you will probably get close to that number. If you have three closers, you may exceed it. Or what will most likely happen, you have three closers, one of them gets knocked out or hurt or whatever, and you really only have two for a while. So I think the 71 saves is the most important number on these pitcher totals. The WHIP seems lower than maybe it's my perception on WHIP. 80th percentile WHIP was 116, which is like damn good.
That's really good. Aaron Nola was 120, and we used to think that like 116 is impressive
compared to 358 ERA. Jeff Zimmerman put a tweet out today about this because he's working on the process about WHIP and ERA, and he basically I may get the exact number wrong, but like having a 1.3 WHIP on your for a starter is as damaging as having a 460 ERA. We think of 460 as awful, and maybe I kind of gloss over it, a 130 WHIP. You need to have good WHIP. So 116 WHIP is really low, and that's your 80th percentile target. So that's pretty much all I got on the pitching side.
Yeah, it's just something to think about when you're. I think it's almost like Rob DiPietro and other guys talk about working backwards to forwards in a draft and what you want to do. I think trying to figure out how you want to attack the pitching stats here in your 80th percentile will help you build your hitters later. Yep. If that makes sense to anybody, that's how I would think. Like, how do I want to get this pitching threshold figured out and go from there?
And I really use my reliever plan to guide my starting pitcher plan.
Yes, 100%. Because those are, you can, like we said a million times, it's the last thing I'll say on this is you can find a lot of spec seventh and eighth starters late. You can't find a lot of fourth and fifth closers late. That just doesn't happen. You might get a bunch of option B's, but you're not gonna get a bunch of option E and F's at that position, so keep that in mind. All right, let's take a quick look at a tool that you have put together over at the Patreon. Ryan, I'm gonna leave the floor to you on this one because this is one of your things.
All right, so this just kind of ties together everything we've talked about so far. Our roster construction, right? How many guys at each position we want to draft, and then B, what our category targets are. So I've used this for the last couple of years. It's a basic draft and hold like team tracker where you enter your picks and this is nothing groundbreaking, but it adds everything up and says how you're doing in terms of your category targets. But what it's specifically useful for me is I kind of hard code these positions. So I've got the starting positions up at the top, and then I've got, as we talked about, I want to get four catchers. I want to get at least three at every infield position. This kind of, when I'm building out my reserves, I can go in and select and drop, in this drop down and fill out my team and track my team by not only just by category, but by position. I think that helps me a lot, especially once you get to the 40th round or whatever, you can pretty easily see, oh, I need, two more infielders or I need three more outfielders. And you can see kind of where you're deficient, not only in categories, but also by position. And then, typical Bloom board fashion, the key stats for me are color coded, so I can quickly tell like Where am I good in at-bats? Where am I strong in homers? Where am I strong in steals? That sort of thing. On this team that I'm showing on the actual stream, this was my meatball draft. And I can just look, I'm behind in steals. We did this draft before projections even existed. And I needed, again, 13 per player. I'm down at 11. I just look down my stolen base column. It's ugly. I've got CJ Abrams at 39. This is all projections. So this sheet also uses Steamer projections that I can basically update every day. I've got Abrams at 39, Arozarena, Springer. Those are my only hitters with 15 plus projected stolen bases. So like if I was doing this draft again with projections, I would probably have a little bit more stolen base safety than what I have on this team right now. I know people don't care about my team or whatever, but that's just a specific example of how you could use this kind of team tracker to see, am I putting all my stolen base eggs in one basket? How am I tracking versus my categories and that sort of thing? You kind of run that same exercise across the different categories. So again, this uses Steamer projections. I use this all the time. I make a new tab for each team that I have throughout draft and hold season, and it works really well for me. So I wanted to share it out also with folks that are on the Patreon. I ran it by some of the folks in the Discord last week, and folks seem to like it. So we'll make this part of the perks of signing up if you're interested.
It's also interesting because you're looking at the per player totals. Above it, you have your team totals, and just being two stolen bases short per player, it puts you 44 short overall. It's like saying it just shows you the differences of how much you mentioned it earlier. If you draft like one guy that puts you behind, it could set you back a couple, but you know, the whole team, the more you do it, it just shows the gap stretch out and really emphasizes certain needs over others. So that is interesting. Now the pitcher sides, it's tougher because we know pitching projections, but at the same time, it still gives you a good idea to mix and match there as well.
It gives you a rough, am I good in strikeouts or not? Ratios are so hard to project. Do I have two to three closers? That sort of thing. I think it's a good way to kind of just do a little sanity check on your team, both in terms of category, but also where you're falling back in positions. So
for sure. Looking forward to playing around with that some more. Should be some fun stuff over there. With the tracker, I should put my team in there now to see how far off I am on everything.
You should see. I should have put your squad in there and see who.
What I need, but
well, it doesn't matter what you need anymore because it's.
Oh, you're talking about the meatball squad. Yeah, the meatball squad. Yes,
How badly I'm beating you in the meatball projections.
Okay. That's why they play the games, as Chris Berman once said. That's why they play the games. All right, let's talk about some of the top finishing teams just to get an idea on how things go around here. Are we bringing these up or no?
Yeah, let's bring them up.
Okay.
So we're looking at the same thing.
Yeah. The first, the overall winner was Steve Weimer. Second was Dustin McComas, who won the CLQ, finished first there. Our buddy Rob DiPietro finished third in the DC, and Brophy finished fourth.
Michael Brophy, I think.
Apologies. But here's Steve Weimer's team up on the board here. And like I said earlier, he's pretty much the best DC player I've seen in my time doing this. The dude's just amazing, a pure juggernaut in these. He drafted this team, I believe, in late October, early November is when this team was drafted.
Yeah.
And as Ryan said, the easiest way to describe it, he didn't miss. So what do you notice when you see this team, Ryan?
So what we're looking at is basically who Steve took, and really all this top five, who they took in what round, and then how they finished on the Fangraphs player rater, right? Kind of consistent with our position review episodes. And there's a ton of course, Oregon Duck Green and not much Rare Steak Red on this one. Any good team is going to be like that. But it's just
one of your favorite multi-position guys is on there, but that's it.
Where are we at? Drury?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, Weimer was on board with my guy, and it was just that's validation for me, actually.
I think he's just such a nice guy. He had to throw you a bone, even though he knew he was already winning the league.
It's cool to see just different ways, and that's kind of the exercise I want to take it with these top teams. Like there's different ways to start them, I guess. The way Steve did it was he did not miss at all in the first, really. 13 of his first 14 picks were all, I don't want to say perfect, but we're all, every single one of them hit. It helps to start Bobby Witt, Shohei Ohtani, and then get Tarik Skubal in the fifth round. But he also got his closers locked up. He had Raisel Iglesias in the fourth round, then Kenley Jansen I think took a late.
He had Ronaldo Lopez really late.
He had a late Ronaldo Lopez. It was really the it was the start for Steve that just put him so far ahead. Some middle round dominance at Taylor Ward, 16th round, 17th round, Jeremy Pena, Brenton Doyle, your guy.
Yes,
that'll be a common theme. 27th round, finished 45th. That's huge. You just said Ronaldo Lopez. There wasn't as many, like I always expect like a bunch of like 40th round and later kind of hits. And sometimes that's how the main event or the DC champion does it. Steve's case, he didn't really hit much in the 40th round or later. He didn't need to, just because he did not miss in these first really 27 rounds. It was damn impressive.
And like we've said before, there's lots of ways to do this. It's just fun to see picks 3, 4, 5, Burns, Raisel Iglesias, Skubal. So gets one of the best closers out there. We've talked about Iglesias a ton. But with Burns and Skubal, he got two innings machines with great ratios. Skubal gets all the strikeouts. Burns gets enough due to accumulation through innings. And it just turns into, it's kind of like we talk about with plate appearances at bats with hitters. You get those elite innings with ratios. It just like lock, and then you throw Lopez in later. He gets three pitchers with great ratios and innings, and it just kind of helps pencil things in, not to mention many other. I'm not going to go over all of his pitching picks, but just right. To see three in the first five there, as you know, we've talked about, you can wait, but you can also go early. Don't go overkill would be my saying, but it's pretty sweet. And then you get Bobby Witt, who could have won the MVP, and Shohei, who will in the MVP. That's pretty sweet first two hitters. So yeah, it's a pretty impressive draft.
And last thing, just looking through Steve's hitters that he took, almost all of them outside of Brandon Drury, Jamer Candelario, Tommy Pham, almost all of his hitters that he took in the first 27 rounds were full-time players.
Yeah.
And we're all season. So like, that's what we talk about when we talk about maximizing at-bats. You look at every single hitter that Steve took outside of those three that I mentioned, and you're never going to be perfect on this. That is damn impressive.
Yep. And as Scott Burks mentions, nobody on the left side was out for an extended period of time with injury. Like, right. Top of the head, Drury and Hayes.
Drury, you wanted to be injured.
Yeah, but based on, like, Hayes and Drury probably spent the most time on that whole left side on the IL. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. So, yeah, I missed Hayes. That's a good call.
It's pretty good stuff there. All right, let's check out McComas, who finished second overall in the DC. Like I said, finished first in the CLQ. When I had Toby on my show last week, Bench with Bubba, we were recapping the CLQ, and a trend, if you're playing the CLQ and you want to finish high, your CLQ DC team has to do very well. So that's one of the things that had a trend through most of them. And here's Dustin's team. So what do you see when you look at Dustin's, besides a lot of green on the left side again?
All these teams are going to have a lot of green. The thing with Dustin was a couple early misses. And this is one point I want to drive home where we talk about this, but you can miss early picks and still do quite well. Dustin took, this was probably an early draft before Devin Williams was hurt, obviously. Yes. Dustin McComas took Devin Williams in the fourth round. And so that obviously as a fourth round pick, we'll get there in a second, but that was a bummer. I'll just get to it now. He handcuffed Devin Williams in the 40th round with Trevor McGill. And so while the Devin Williams pick in a vacuum doesn't look good in the fourth round, that's the benefit to your handcuff. If you're confident in a setup man behind a good closer, no matter how good they are, this is a perfect handcuff for Dustin, where like he really did get full value from that pick. It just cost him a 40th round handcuff with Trevor McGill.
Man, it's interesting looking at a lot of his relievers just in general. I don't see a lot of guys outside of Holmes, McGill, and Williams that were even really considered closers. Like maybe Bender. He would have been one from Miami super late, but he didn't really. His relievers are more, I'm going to take a lot of sixth, seventh inning guys or long reliever guys, which is, like we talked about earlier, a different way to do it. But if you have lockdown guys, if it's between Williams and McGill, what do you get? 45 saves or so? Like that's pretty good.
And then a good bunch from Clay Holmes. I mean, he didn't finish the season in the role. But Dustin probably wants that pick back as an eighth round. I mean, he doesn't really want any of these back. He finished second overall.
Did pretty good.
Certainly wants the Chris Bassett in the ninth round pick back. So again, it's just you can have a couple misses and still be really, you know, really strong. The reason Dustin was able to overcome some of those misses, dude, his round 10 through 14, Sal Perez, who finished 29th overall in the 10th, Marcelo Zuna finished 14th overall, Nick Pavetta, Brandon Nimmo was a top 100 player, and then Bryce Miller in the 14th round, 32. He dominated those middle rounds, and you know me, that helps. And then Brenton Doyle, again, 27th round, finished 45th overall, and then hit on a late Luis Gil. So just wanted to, I think my bigger takeaway with Dustin's team is a couple early misses. You can still overcome that if you nail those middle rounds and get a couple late guys. And if you handcuff that closer, that can work out for you too.
Yeah, I just noticed if I look to the next two teams, Brandon Nimmo was on the top four teams with Brenton Doyle.
On all four.
Yeah, really? On the top four. Yeah, that stands out right out the gate. So Nimmo, Brenton Doyle. I know you mentioned someone else. I can't remember who it was now. But yeah, there are some themes to this situation. Very, very interesting stuff there.
Jared Jones. Sorry. Brenton Doyle and Jared Jones. So Jared Jones like doesn't pop on this board because it's a 286 overall, but obviously he missed a ton of time and you probably hopefully benched his last few starts. So Jared Jones was also a nail pick. And yeah, the top three finishers had both Brenton Doyle and Jared Jones on their teams. So that obviously helps.
All right, let's look at DiPietro's real quick and then we'll move on to the last few topics here on the show. But another guy that took care of business early and often in this draft, and another Shohei guy up top, which is always a plus. But another Scooble pick in here as well. But he's kind of in that the middle round. Like, just, God, he crushed again. So there's Nimmo. What are some of your takeaways here? Because outside of Emmett Sheehan and Tyler Black, the first 25 rounds are pretty lucrative for him.
Yeah. Yes. Rob did not miss really at all outside of Sheehan. You could say probably Bo Naylor, but yeah, in a two catcher league, that wasn't, well, it was bad, but whatever.
I'm not going to throw shade that direction.
Yep, absolutely. And actually Bo Naylor was Rob's second pick. He took Wilson Contreras in the 10th. So I don't know how much he got catcher wise out of this team. The only other catcher that I'm seeing, James, no, he had Hunter McCann. Goodman and James McCann. So
Goodman got it late though. Just remember that.
Goodman got it late. That's correct. So, yeah. Rob was, you probably say, deficient in catcher. You can still win though. Again, every team's going to have holes. You can win with those holes. The biggest thing that I take away from Rob's team that's different than the other two, because again, we have Jared Jones and Brenton Doyle and we have a ton of early hits. Rob, look at this, like 44th round and beyond. It was even, hell, 42nd. He had Joey Cantillo in the 42nd round, which, you know, overall rank isn't going to look great, but Rob had Joey Cantillo available to him over those last few weeks of the season, which was huge. Spencer Arrighetti in the 44th round. Cade Povich, another strong finisher, in the 45th. He had Trevor McGill in the 46th round. I think he did not take Devin Williams, no, I don't believe. Not. So this is one where you take a spec on a closer and you hit the jackpot. You have an extra closer. That was the 46th round. Then it was Joey Ortiz in the 47th round. Kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about these hitters. Joey Ortiz wasn't that sexy, but he was multi-position and he played a ton, finished 240 overall. To get that in the 47th round is awesome. And then he polished it off with JJ Bladé in the 50th round.
I love that pick. Like, he was never around that. He was never around that late in my draft. So that's a beauty to fall at 50 to him.
Yep. Yep. So this was the most impressive out of the teams I looked at, the most impressive finish. And it kind of goes to show while you're drafting after the 40th round, it looks completely bare, but you can absolutely, make hay with some of those picks, and that's what Rob did, contrary to the two teams that finished ahead of him. So
yeah, one thing that Michael C just mentions in the chat here, he said it's interesting that Dustin did not take an outfielder until Nimmo. That was round 13, his first outfielder. That is very interesting, because then his next outfielder is Parker Meadows, who really didn't hit till late. Haniger, Mickey Moniak, So Willier Abreu, Brenton Doyle, did Jake Myers for a while there, did a lot of his damage. That's impressive.
Yeah, that is. And Scott says he only had one closer in his first 25 picks. If you don't count Devin Williams, but yeah.
Yeah, that's impressive stuff. These guys did good. Did good as you would expect if you're finishing in the top three on these. All right. Couple of miscellaneous things we'll discuss here before we get some listener questions and head out on our primer episode for you. Let's get to prospects versus boring veterans. This is a fun one because I am not a prospect guru by any means. I try to do my research the best I can. We kind of rely on other smart people to help us in that direction. I'm not a risk drafter for the most part, so I will take veterans that are boring. I've already mentioned like Jonah Bride and some other guys, but there are angles. I mentioned like my fourth catcher could be a prospect. I could see angles to prospects. How do you approach the situation?
I don't know how to approach the situation because it's freaking hard, but that's one of the more common questions I think we get to, especially when you're like rounding out your depth, right? Yep. You know, your starting lineup. Maybe you take a shot on a Churio, Jackson Holliday, etc. But really what I wanted to look at, so I looked at last year's data. I wanted to look at all for the hitters that were taken after the first 30 rounds, like how many were prospects, how many were young major leaguers, how many were olds like us. So out of the, and this is going to be kind of numbery, but bear with me. This is all written out in the Patreon post, but there were like 51,000 hitters taken last year outside the top 30. Roughly a quarter of them had less than 100 career plate appearances in the majors entering the season. So they were basically prospects. So that's one thing. A quarter of hitters taken after the 30th round last season were prospects. Of all of those guys, only one finished in the top 100. You want to guess who
Jackson,
it is?
Jackson Churio.
It's Jackson Merrill. Jackson Churio is expensive. So Jackson Merrill was the only prospect last season taken outside the top 30 that finished in the top 100. 10% of them finished in the top 300. So you had a 1 in 10 chance. If you took a prospect late last season, you had a 1 in 10 chance. I'm rounding just so it's easier to listen to with numbers. 10% of them finished in the top 300. Sedan Rafaela, Colton Cowser.
Cowser, so I was wondering where he was.
Hamilton of Boston.
David Hamilton, yeah.
Your guy, because I always get the first name wrong. But your guy, Elliot Ramos. Yvonne Herrera, catcher, of course. Yes. Jackson Merrill, Luis Ortiz. Michael Bush, PCA, Tyler Fitzgerald, Willier Abreu, and Xavier Edwards. Those were the guys. Those were that 10% of prospects that finished in the top 300.
See, don't want you to name them off. I'm curious which ones failed that were popular, if that makes sense. Because, like, looking back, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. But who would have drafted all? Like, some of them, I actually had Edwards on a couple teams, but I wouldn't have had all those guys. That's for darn sure. That'd be an interesting look back up. But bottom line is, you said a quarter were prospects and 10% of that quarter produced. So, for talking, you said 5,000 or whatever. So you take a quarter, we're talking 1,250. Now you take 10%, 125 panned out. Am I doing math right or no?
Times 10, there are 50,000 picks. There's
a lot. Oh, you said 50,000. I was doing 5,000. Yeah. Sorry. But
it's all good. The percentages are the ones that matter. So yeah, a quarter of the hitters taken late were prospects. 10% of those finished strong in the top 300. The last thing I looked at with these in each of these groups, did they just out earn their draft price? So like, did they play and did they at least like do something to, you know, if you picked them 400, did they finish 375 or something? One out of five of the prospects out earn their draft price. All right. I'll jump to the other two cohorts here so one out of five for prospects. For players with less than 1,000 career plate appearances entering 2024, 43% of them out earned their draft price. So more than double the hit rate for young major league players than prospects
with some experience.
Yeah,
that tells me a lot, kind of more to what kind of guys I'd like to draft. So that's interesting.
Taking so that even further, just real quick, and then I'll give you the floor. Anyone with over 1,000 career plate appearances entering the season, the chance of them out-earning their draft price, 48%, so basically half. So again, prospects were 20%, young major leaguers were like 40, 42%, and the older guys over 1,000 plate appearances were basically 50% out-earning their draft price.
Interesting. So you could try to take the flashy name, see how it panned out, but then you got your like Jackson Holidays, who actually probably went before 300, before the 30th round. But
yeah, he did.
But then you got this core of guys that might have played a year or so that actually, like, you maybe your Taylor Wards, if he went that late, I can't remember. But those are the kind of guys that are coming off the top of my head, basically.
And of that crew, that kind of young major league crew, so there were only, and this was another one, there were only two of them finished in the top 100. It was Brenton Doyle and Alec Burleson.
Okay.
So, you know, no, like, major breakouts. But here's another. So the guys that finished in the top 300 of this young major league crew, remember, prospects, it was like a 1 in 10 chance to finish in the top 300. For this group, 1 to 2 years major league experience, it was almost 20% finished in the top 300. So almost a 1 in 5. It's Brenton Doyle, Burleson, David Fry, Ernie Clement, I did it on plate appearances, not on time served. But a couple other names, Jacob Young, McCarthy, J.J. Bladé, Joe Adell, Joey Bart, Caballero, Miranda, Josh H. Smith, Higgy, Lawrence Butler, Mark Vientos, Matt Vierling, Michael Toglia, Nolan Shanwell, and Trevor Larnach. Those were the guys with less than 1,000 career plate appearances entering 2024, taken after the 30th round, that finished in the top 300.
That is interesting stuff. So it kind of fits my idea of a little more cautious, but doesn't have to be like full on old guys. So that's interesting. Definitely something to dig into for 2025 to kind of, when we start talking that in another week or two on one of our upcoming shows, that'd be fun to kind of see where that those pockets land. So you don't have to go boring veterans, but you don't have to go prospects is what we're trying to say on this one. There's you can kind of fit in the middle there and do as good as you would if you did boring veterans, basically. And you might have more upside with the young guys if it's on the right teams.
That's what I also saw. So the boring veterans over 1,000 career plate appearances. So even though the most of any kind of these three kind of groups of players, they were the highest to at least out earn their draft price. Only 12% of them finished in the top 300. So roughly the same as prospects. So what I'm kind of saying is like, yeah, that sweet spot. And there's not many of them, but that sweet spot is, again, this is after the 30th round, is that kind of 1 to 2 year major leaguer, less than 1,000 career plate appearances. Again, in 2024, that was your best bet in terms of having like a good hit, which was top 300 finish, but also out earning your draft price. For me, the prospects, it was dicey, man. Like only 1 out of 5 to out earn your price. Like that tells me 4 out of 5 pretty much did nothing.
Wasn't it 1 out of 10?
1 out of 10 finished in the top 300.
Oh, my bad. Sorry.
Yes. So yeah, I know it's a lot of numbers.
I don't have it on my pad of paper here, so it's hard for me to keep track.
You're all thrown off. Now you with the prospects, you had a 1 in 10 chance to finish in the top 300, which is like a pretty good hit, and then a 1 in 5 chance to at least get your draft price. So it just tells me that it's a lot of, you can kind of take the risk on those prospects, but again, 4 out of 5, you didn't earn your draft price, and that's a low bar to clear because these are post 30 round picks.
Looking at you, Victor Scott. All right, we mentioned timing of backups. You mentioned it earlier when I took Bregman right behind Royce Lewis. We've talked Devin Williams, making sure you get Trevor McGill potentially last year. I'm guessing there's a slow draft he was involved in for that one. So getting your handcuff closer potentially could be something to get a little earlier. I think it's just, it's obviously player dependent on when you want to attack the back end of that. But do you have any recommendations there? It's more of a situational thing. Like, I knew Royce Lewis, I love his upside, but I'm also realistic on the injury concerns with the guy. So get someone a little more stable. I guess if you go and get a young player early, you could probably back him up with a boring veteran type thing, stuff like that.
It's kind of that, like, so, I mean, my general strategy is the later I take my starter, the earlier I'm going to take their backup. Just in general, the earlier I take the starter, if I take a first round, I don't know, Who didn't get hurt that was in the first round last year? If I take Bobby Witt, maybe that's a bad example, but I won't take like my backup shortstop until later because I drafted Bobby Witt. And yes, he may get hurt, but you kind of have to hedge because you can't have full backups at every, something has to give. So generally I inverse it. The earlier I take my starter, the later take my backup, and vice versa is generally how it goes. That burned me a couple times last year. I took an early Austin Riley and kind of said, screw it, this guy's safe at third base and I'm just gonna let it ride, and I got burned by that. But you know, again, you can't predict this stuff. So I also think like maybe handcuffing that, as hard as it is to try to predict a backup third baseman for the Braves in December, yeah, that could also be a viable strategy. Like maybe if you go an early CJ Abrams, maybe you take a late Nassim Nunez or something, just so you have that backup on your team. So handcuffs can work for hitters, like they might be able to for closers.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, you know, the Giants. Did you really want to back up with Brett Wisely? Stuff like that. My point is most backups are backups for a reason. So you got to find the unique situation, I guess, where it's like, okay, this guy can be viable, I guess, in the grand scheme of things, which is not always the most easy thing to do. So that'd be my only two cents there. It's tricky. I get where your head's at, especially Nunez is a good example because the Nats had some openings. Maybe with like the Orioles, when you know they have a lot of those guys with like four good outfielders, go get that fourth outfielder type situation, because eventually that'll come crashing down. Like the Rays situation just got a little not easier with Siri out of town, but now maybe Josh Lopez more. Maybe DeLuca's penciled in because his defense is better in center field, moves him up, so on and so forth. That changes things. Dodgers is a very sticky predicament right now with Pajes and others, and they might sign a guy. Like there's certain teams that you can play around with that right now and see where it goes. Like fourth outfielders are like fifth and sixth starter or sixth and seventh starters type thing. That kind of covers handcuffs. We're not going to go any farther on that, but draft queues, you have a great point here, cause we were actually talking about this in the chat. Like there's slow drafts right now. 4 hours is kind of the sweet spot. There's 2 hours as well, but after pick 30, cut in half. So be prepared. It starts especially 4 hours, goes to 2 hours, goes to 1. And if you like to go to bed on the West Coast, because in the draft I'm in right now, I got two East Coasters next to me. I like to clock out every night. And so I've woken up, thank God I wake up early. I've been on the clock like every morning.
Yeah, it goes without saying. But yeah, set your draft queue so you don't get autoed, you know, whoever is there. I am guilty of not doing my queue late at night, and then I wake up and my pick is gone and I'm on auto. And it's not a good way to start your day.
Especially when you get certain players you really want nothing to do with. That is not a fun place to be at all.
Correct.
All right, let's do some listener questions here, as I think we covered everything. Do you have anything else, Ryan, or do you want to hit the questions?
Who knows? We could talk forever about this, but no, I'm getting fired up to draft. Let's do questions.
Good to hear. In the YouTube chat here, Dan Huzzle says, rank these pitchers for keepers, probably going to keep two or three. So he's got Lugo, Gilbert, Flaherty, Luis Gil, Scherzer, Bieber, Snell, and Gallen. Nice spelling of that. I'm going to go with Gilbert, Snell, and it's between Gil and Flaherty. I'd probably go Flaherty. Who would you like here?
Do Gilbert, Snell, Gallen.
That's fair. Yeah.
Gilbert, sure. By far. Yeah.
Gilbert and Snell.
And then Snell. You have a top two there.
For sure. You got those locked down for you. All righty. Let's get our listener
questions. This is where I want to see Bubba struggle, because now we have, not only with the advent of our Discord, which gets, you know, we got a bunch of questions, but now Bubba also has to check that. He's got to check Twitter, which we have, and now we're on the Blue Sky, and there's questions coming in from the Blue Sky. So, well, I mean, this is why we pay you the big bucks, man.
That's what it is. Okay. From our Discord here, TCAT says, does a player having his contract selected from the minors in the offseason mean anything significant for the coming season? He mentioned like Owen Cassie, Zach Veen. For those that were keeping track, today was the Rule 5 deadline, so they had to be put on the 40-man roster or they become eligible in the Rule 5 draft. My quick and short part of this is, they make them much more intriguing for late round DC targets because they're on the roster. So they're the next options to get called up, where if you're looking at certain guys in the past, like this is a good prospect, but he's not on the 40 man. There's another barrier to get on the team that they have to cross, that some teams aren't as happy to jump over. So the fact like Zach Veen is on the 40 man for the Rockies, and Rockies are usually a bad example for prospects, but he's a talented guy, that would help a little bit, and so on and so forth down the list. Anything else on that?
No, full agree. The only thing I'll add there is when I look at prospects for draft and hold, I would say even more important than their like prospect rating or whatever, what's their path to playing time?
Yep.
For draft and hold. You could have the best prospect in the world. If he's not going to play this year, it does nothing for you. So analyzing those playing time situations by team and seeing which prospect has that best path to even just get a shot. And then once they get a shot, who knows? That's just as important as the prospect pedigree and the stats and all that. And yeah, having being selected on the 40 man is, that can't hurt. It can't hurt. Yep.
Derek in the Discord says, multi-part question. In terms of roster construction, how many pitchers do you target to have on a roster? What type of SP, right, RP splits? We mentioned that, 16-6, roughly.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
When evaluating late-round relief pitchers, thoughts on targeting specific closer specs versus middle relievers with great ratios and or high K rates? Kind of hit on that. You prefer the specs, right?
I prefer the specs and the handcuffs. I'm a handcuff guy. That's
just gonna leave that alone. Yeah, just leave that alone. That's low hanging fruit right there.
Yeah, that's put that one. But the thing is, you only get like three or four backup relievers, so you got to pick. You got to pick. But those are your options. I go handcuff.
You got to pick the lock. That's for sure. All right, Michael C in the Discord here says, if you miss for example, the locked in closer run, do you ever punt it later for specs only, same for speed? So if like you miss the elite closers, do you ever punt it? I'd say no.
I've never done it. You could do it though.
You better be very confident in your specs. You have to move them up a few rounds.
Or you could just punt the whole thing. Like I wouldn't enter a draft with that strategy. A good number, some of your entry, at least in the NFBC, goes towards an overall. Newsflash, you're not going to win the overall. There's 5,000 teams. Like, chances of that are low.
You can't punt any stat in those, for sure.
And you can't punt any stat in an overall. But you can do very well in a league to where, like, say you're on the end, you're on 1 or 15, and there's just this massive closer run, and there's literally nobody. I'd rather punt it than try and reach for closers that don't even have the job. It's a strategy. I have not done it. I have tried to kind of patch it with late specs because what can you can't hurt you too much if they don't hit, but you could go full punt at that point if you wanted to.
Yep. Totally agree with you on that. All right. TCAT has another question for the show. I said I'll address this, but we will answer this for you in a future episode. He was asking a question about positional eligibility. I will save this for a future episode. TCAT. Paul Coughlin says, I think my issue is when the late round, say 35 or later, any insight would be appreciated, assuming you see this is in the next 14 minutes. Yes, we got you. So he's talking about like late round picks. Well, we kind of highlighted you didn't have to be that great if you got the early picks, but what's your approach with the late rounds?
I mean, just kind of thinking back through all the hitter stats I just rattled off, like I would target guys in their first or second year coming off a bad major league season, because that's probably why they're so cheap after the 35th round. I mean, at first pitch, you did your panel on the next Jurickson and Profar. Like those types of players are the ones you'd want to target. Again, at least last season, those were the most fruitful in terms of, and it's still low chances to hit, but those are the most fruitful in terms of earning their draft price, but also potentially being a top 300 player. So those young hitters that have at least taken their lumps with a season or two of MLB experience.
Yep, I agree. Take those shots there and try to fill out some depth to your roster would be my best advice for you. Tommy D in the Discord says, considering the crapshoot that pitching is, where the hardest throwers are almost stone-cold locks for missing time to injury, and we already have some quality arms that won't be coming back until mid-season, does a strategy of going super heavy on the top arms over hitting make sense in a draft and hold, i.e., in the first 10 picks, grab 7 pitchers. First 15, grab 10. Outside of the dearth of average in later rounds, it seems like you could piece together enough hitting by stockpiling pitching early, and you lock others out of bigger names. Obviously, could backfire.
Yeah, I mean, anything can and probably will backfire. when you're drafting this early. I tend to not spend the top dollar picks on pitchers. I'd like to go hitters early, and then I'm going to volume my way with the pitcher. So like, it's not crazy for me to have like after 10 rounds, four hitters and six pitchers, but probably two or three of my first four picks are going to be hitters. Like I'm going to heavy load it with hitters on the early in the draft.
Yep. I'm with you on that one. I'm not going to go too, I see his idea behind it. Yep. I get the idea. That's just something I'm not gonna walk away with in a draft. I'll say that much. It's just,
but I do think it's important to say, like it's easy to say, oh, pitchers are gonna hurt, I'm gonna avoid them. I don't think that's the way to, like, you kind of got to lean into it and just volume your way through it, and that way you can take a couple hits and still field a team.
And no, for the most part, you're not gonna be alone. Like, not correct. Everyone's gonna get nailed with it, but for the most part, everyone's dealing with the same minefield. Yes. So if that one guy figures it out, kudos, congratulations. It's not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah.
All right, Ryan, that's it. Got them all. Going to wrap it up there. Any final thoughts on the draft and hold primer for 2025?
No, I hope that was helpful for everyone. Again, for the Patreon, I'll kind of put out my written notes and then a link to the team tracker. Hope that's useful. Let me know. If it's not, I can change things around and play it by ear. But I don't know. Hopefully we covered it for you all, especially if you're kind of newer to the format and trying to get in. I'm sure we'll probably do, as I talk out of turn, we got to set up a draft and hold listener league. It'd be fun.
We could probably figure something out. I know we'll do our...
Either NFBC or fan tracks, maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
We can do NFBC. That's always good. I know we'll do our post, was it 500 ADP draft in a couple weeks? So... That'll be fun. That'll be fun to kind of give people an idea there, because we'll look back on last year. We each had a couple pretty strong ones. Not all of them hit, obviously, but we had a couple that were pretty good.
Bubba picked Xavier Edwards. We'll tease that one out. That was freaking sweet.
That one worked out well. So we'll have some fun with that here in a couple of weeks, kind of getting some more ADP to kind of even things out before we get to that. But we'll have you covered there. We'll cover more strategy over the coming weeks and some more, you know, projections and other cool stuff to get you ready before we start positional previews in probably another month and a half. But we'll get you covered here. Don't forget Thursday night live Gladiator, 8:30 p.m. Pacific time, right here on the YouTube feed, and will be available for your listening pleasure the following day. That'll be a lot of fun. And I think that's it, Ryan. I think we're going to wrap it up there. All right, make sure you check out Ryan on Twitter at RyanBHQ, the podcast at Bubba Bloom Pod. I am at BDentric. Until next time, this was Bubba and the Bloom, episode 188. Catch y'all later.